Say that again. Let me make sure I get it.
If it is not acceptable for me to say no to a request you make of me, my yes has no integrity.
Oh, that's great.
And what happens in the workplace is we defer to stature, power,
right.
influence, mm-hmm. and we think to ourselves, we can't say no, that there would be a clear career-limiting move, or I might get fired, or I won't get the next plum assignment, whatever it is we tell ourselves inside our head. But the problem is, if we say yes, and we don't stay in the conversation to find out what are the conditions of success or satisfaction, I'm going to start down a road, and I'm just made a formula for failure.
Hey, this is William Pidcup, Ryan Leary, and you are listening to the You Should Know podcast. We've got Janet on today, and we've got a great topic. I can't wait for this. So, Janet, we've been talking about your art, so let's go ahead and do some introductions. Would you do us a favor and introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And maybe in a less traditional way, because you've probably got my bio posted someplace, right?
Yes.
You know, part of my work has always been about bringing people back home to themselves, to the true self, to the essence of who they are. And one of the ways we do that is to help them to curate the essence traits of who they are. So I'm going to tell you what my essence statement is.
Okay.
I am alchemical seer.
Okay.
Sovereign, radiant love. Black pearl beauty, savvy sassy, generous expression, riding on the winds of joy.
How do you beat that, Ryan? Can you beat that? You can't beat that. Beat that, right? I can't beat it. I don't even know to know what mine is.
Yeah, I was thinking like,
I'm afraid.
Yeah.
That's an awesome introduction.
Can you tell me what mine is?
I could reflect back to you some traits that I experience of you, but ultimately only you can answer that question, right? Everybody has an experience of you. We rarely know what it is unless we ask somebody to do it. And that's often a part of the process, right? Ask three people. If you could name three or four traits that you associate with me, what would those be? And that would be a place for you to start.
That is so awesome.
I'm not that sure I so want to awesome. Start there, though.
Yeah, no.
Might be a little scary.
You might find this as a gender thing, Janet, or not. But it might be just Ryan and I. But I'm terrified.
I will tell you, most people start there, and then they are moved by extraordinary reflections that come back. People in your life love you. And they really actually appreciate being given the opportunity to reflect back who you've been in their lives.
That's insane. That's insane. But I know what you're talking about, because I usually see it a little bit dark, but I usually see it at funerals.
Yeah, that's right. And boy, isn't that just sad that we go our entire adult life and
not know how much you meant to somebody, or not know that there were other people. Like when my father passed in 21, there were people that showed up, and this was during COVID-ish. Mm-hmm. There were people that showed up to his funeral that I would have never, ever expected. And I mean, it was during COVID, so you had the chairs, so I had to be all spaced out and kind of, it was an inconvenience, quote unquote. But it was a trip to just kind of, I met everybody that came, and it was just interesting. Like some people, check. I knew that they'd be there, et cetera. But like, there was a ton of people in the room that I'm like, he must have impacted them in some way. Because why would they?
You were, William. It's impact. You know, I suspect you have many people in your audience who have never told you how important and valuable having the cadence of a regular program from you with useful content is to their lives. And I had somebody enroll in one of our programs 2 days ago who said, I have been following you since 2015. I've watched every YouTube. I've watched your TEDx. I've read both your books. Anytime you are anywhere in the world on a webinar, I am listening. And I knew someday I'd be in your course room.
Wow.
That's humbling.
I was like, my gosh, almost a little overwhelming, right?
Right. Here's Ryan and I. The difference between the two is Ryan said, that's humbling. And I was thinking, can I ask, can I borrow for $20? I wouldn't, obviously. But you're right. Like, I'm thinking back to time spent 100 years ago when I was real young in Midland, Texas. And I didn't grow up, I grew up with two older brothers, so I didn't grow up, I didn't know how to iron. And I had to go to this thing where you had to have, I had button shirts and stuff like that, but I didn't know how to iron. My rendition of ironing was throw the shirt in the dryer with like a wet wash rag and then take it out really quickly and it was ironed.
Good idea. That's pretty good.
It works. It works.
Yeah. But my best friend that I met in Midland, he taught me how to iron. But now we drink a lot of gin, and so there was... I'm not sure if it was just the ironing, but one night we had an ironing. I had gotten so good, because we're competitive, I got so good that I challenged him to an iron off.
Oh, yeah.
And so we drank a bottle of gin, and we ironed shirts.
You're
hilarious.
Not gaining any cool points here, you know.
No.
Well,
no.
Maybe he's redefining cool, Ryan. Come on.
That's exactly right.
He could ingenuity be. Here.
He I can be. Iron. That was in 88. I can still iron to this day. You give me a shirt, I can iron it.
I have a lot in common. Yes, he's a really good ironer.
I can make a shirt stand up. I can iron it so well. Yeah.
What do you need a can of starch? You can do
that. Exactly. There might be three or four cans of starch involved, but I can make it stand up. Anyhow, we have a wonderful topic to discuss with you, and it starts with tension at work. So, in your travels and in your studies, et cetera, what have you seen with tension at work?
So, I always think it's important to know what a speaker's bias is. And so, I'm going to start there, which is. You know, obviously I have a birthmark on my face. So I've had that experience from very young of conflict and tension and discomfort and being different, all those things. I'm also quite fortunate to have had a great education and I'm smart. That also creates conflict and tension and discomfort. And I'll never forget a wonderful boss I had by the name of Beth Sowie. I went into her one day and I said, I'm so tired of people saying they're intimidated by me. They don't even bother to get to know me. Like if they knew me, my heart is like a mush ball. What is this? Sometimes I wish I could just be stupid.
Yeah.
Looked at me right across the desk and said, don't you ever say that again.
Yeah. No, there's, stupid people technically don't know they're stupid, but beyond that, it's a different issue for a different day.
Yeah. And a good one. I will take you up on that.
Okay.
What I learned from what she said to me was that I can only be responsible for myself. When I'm sensitive and paying attention to the influence and the impact I'm having on other people, I can accept responsibility to behave differently. We all have the ability to flex and to adjust and to adapt because the relationship's important to us or it's not.
Right.
In which case, we don't have a right to step on someone else's dignity or be disrespectful, right? We make a decision to walk away from it.
Janet, sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
But have you ever played down your smarts?
No.
Never?
Mm-mm.
Wow.
I don't know what it is.
Cool. That is awesome. That is great. It's unusual. Now, why I've asked the question is there's a lot of people that I've seen, I don't know, if in different tactics, but they basically play it down. They don't play it up. But they don't insert themselves in the way that they could when you have them in a different conversation.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're one-on-one with them and they're just like lights out, smart. And it's like, well, we were just in a group meeting and you...
You were quiet. What's up?
Yeah, you were quiet. Like, well why was that? And so I'm curious about... I was just curious about that.
Well, so not too much of a tangent, really. This notion of we want a psychologically safe environment. And I love Amy Edmondson's work and Dr. Tim Clark, but it's rearview mirror. They're trying to diagnose something symptomatically and apply a solution to it. And so my bias is conflict is not a bad thing. Right. When we remember that the reason conflict surfaces is because something in the current environment no longer satisfies. Now, I've said that rather generically, but think for a moment. You didn't like the date you had at the prom. You don't ask her out again. You don't like your boss. You go to them and say, I want something different to happen. Or you complain to your colleague, and you ultimately leave because there's a values conflict going on. But it's all invisible because it's right. an inside job. We then built a whole industry around conflict management. We're keeping all of the attention on the conflict. We're not paying attention to actually what stimulated the conflict in the first place, which, and here's the great punchline, the seed of innovation, the exact creativity and ingenuity we want in the organization comes out of the conflict.
Yep. I've said this for years around DEI, where the reason you want DEI isn't the reason that you think you want DEI. So all the stuff that's surface like, that's kind of a cotton candy-esque type of stuff, like, okay, we want racial and gender and this and the other, and that's all great. And you can stay there if you'd like, but what that diversity actually creates is conflict. And conflict creates innovation. Innovation creates market share, profit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is, as a capitalist, I don't understand how other capitalists don't understand the fundamentals. Like, it has nothing to do with race and gender. It can.
Right.
Yes.
We can get into incivility for sure. Yeah. But that's an advanced state of the conflict, yeah. right?
Yes.
If we had a different relationship to it, which is why I use the word tension instead of conflict, because
yes.
tension is a sensory experience without all right. the overlay.
Right.
And if we can learn to pay attention that our attention has been moved to something, and then ask the question before we react, what's the reason it's catching my attention? And what am I believing about that? What's the evidence about that? Does it support, or is it my old story? Do I have a habit or a preference or an assumption or a bias that has me caught in seeing this situation as something other than what it is? And if I can't see it, who is in this sphere of influence, in this system that I right. could ask and find out, are you experiencing it like this? Is this what's going on? Because most of the time the answer is no. And then we know it's our work to resolve. It's an internal history that has us caught in something, in conflict, where no conflict exists.
Right.
And if a conflict does exist, now I can be clear. I can sit down with somebody and say, I'm realizing that I've been having this reaction. I don't really know where it's coming from. I want to know your point of view that has us at odds with each other. The act of asking the question activates imagination and right. it builds relationship. Now we have collaboration. So this is a really important stance for leaders to adopt and to get comfortable that they're not going to know. Today's world is way too complex, too much uncertainty and chaos to void themselves of the relationship that can help them learn. How does somebody else see it? What's beyond my habit and preference that's more suited to what's actually occurring in the environment?
Janet, do you see trust as a driver to conflict between employees and leadership? And I ask that because we recently have had some conversations around trust. Uh-huh. And as I think back to when I was in a corporate setting, there was a lot of distrust.
100%.
And it just drove me away. And I didn't have, and this might be a flaw of mine, I didn't have the energy to really deal with it. And I just said, this isn't for me. And I moved on. And so my want for not having conflict caused me to leave.
Yeah.
And I left for good and I never went back to any corporate job. That was it. I was just done. And I kind of broke up with it, divorced it, and moved on. But I just wonder, do you see that as a foundation for a lot of the conflict that doesn't happen or that does happen?
It may depend on how you and I are articulating what we mean by trust. And I think this is an, you know, often studied space. Mm-hmm. And we hide behind trust.
Right.
As a word without asking each other.
What does that mean?
Behaviorally, how would we be being with each other if we were trustworthy in our relationship? Things like reliability, consistency,
right.
congruence between word mm-hmm. and deed, right? These are much more meaningful to create a relationship that will sustain. And I'm going to tell you the most important one. If it is not acceptable to you that I say no, when I say yes, it has no integrity.
Say that again. Let me make sure I get it.
If it is not acceptable for me to say no to a request you make of me, my yes has no integrity.
Oh, that's great.
And what happens in the workplace is we defer to stature, power,
right.
influence, mm-hmm. and we think to ourselves, we can't say no, that there would be a clear career-limiting move, or I might get fired, or I won't get the next plum assignment. Whatever it is, we tell ourselves inside our head. But the problem is, if we say yes, and we don't stay in the conversation to find out what are the conditions of success or satisfaction, I'm going to start down a road, and I'm just made a formula for failure.
Right, right. And how much of that is in my head as opposed to being in reality?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So relationship that allows for compassion and honesty and some directness and recognizing that you're you, I'm me, we have a shared purpose.
Right.
Let's focus there first and then say to each other, what is our highest and best contribution to this shared purpose? And we might decide ultimately, as you did, Ryan, no, I have a values conflict here. You have a point of view I cannot subscribe to, and we walk away from it. But all too often, people walk away under the guise of mistrust, and they just repeat the pattern when they go to the next company.
As he has here.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I love you, too.
I didn't mean to stimulate that. Sorry.
Well, good thing you can play mediator today. Let's talk. No.
How do you teach leaders? Because Ryan said it during pre-show, what we've been taught, you know, for generations at least, is conflict or tension, as we topically. It's bad. That's not something you want in your marriage. That's not something you want in relationships. That's not something you want at work. It's like, what can we do to avoid it at all cost, etc. So how do we go back and rewire corporate America, especially leadership, to then say, actually,
how do we embrace conflict?
You've been taught incorrectly. You actually should want a certain level of tension. And so how do we teach them to be better at tension?
Yeah. I'm not so sure it's a teach. It might be helping them learn to notice and to listen interiorly to the meaning they're making of it. This is often where I'm going to start with someone. And, you know, we had a lot of debate about the title of the book that just released, From Tension to Transformation. And won't surprise you, in the book, I talk about transformation is kind of an oft-used word and really misunderstood. But I want to break it down really simple and say transform, meaning we have a form and we're going to transit from that form to a new form. It's as simple as that. That's all we're doing.
Intellectually at least, when are we not transforming?
We're always transforming.
Okay.
Practically, pragmatically.
That's the stuff that drives me crazy when people talk about change management and transformation. I'm like, do you mean that there's a static state that I'm not aware of? Because I'd like to be in that state sometimes and just be planted there. Because I believe, I mean, it's fluid, it's mercury,
we're always seeking, some of our neurobiology is struck this way to keep us safe, that if we can get something that's familiar and comfortable, we want more of that. So we filter our experience in order to stay in that status quo. Only the environment's not static. So to your point, everything around me is changing. If I'm not adapting, I'm going to be left behind and ultimately be in discomfort.
And the dinosaurs will get you.
And this is how most people change. They have an accident. They have a tragedy. They have a crisis. Their organization has a crisis. And that gives them a moment to pause and reflect and say, what matters to me? One can say the pandemic has done this. For leadership. And some leadership responded to the pandemic with, let's get back to normal as quick as we can.
Right.
As I wrote in my first book, which I released in 2020, I said the year of no return. We fundamentally had a moment when the world hit pause. All 8 billion of us.
Yeah.
We all hit pause at the same time and said, do I really need to spend 4 hours commuting every day? Is this really the work that fills my heart, that has me express my purpose in the world? Am I really getting the time with my family that I want? And we've been reconfiguring our way of being in a livelihood ever since. It's not done yet. The latest data on CEO turnover, we've dropped from average of 12 years to 3.4 years, average tenure of a CEO.
Wow.
Right? So there's
that was 3.4?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the average. Wow.
So that is amazing.
There's a lot of fundamentals that are shifting right now. And I think that I would enter trust, Ryan, first from the self-trust point of view. So many of us in our professional lives were highly rewarded for figuring out what somebody wanted from us and delivering on it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Deliver, deliver, produce, produce, do it on time, do it faster, do it quicker, less resources, all of those wonderful mantras.
Some of that's a mixture of Pavlovian, but also being seeking other people's approval.
Yes, exactly. Sure. So my identity and my sense of self-worth is coming from the external.
Right.
Right.
Until you have one of those sandpaper moments in life and realize, I'm so not happy.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And we start to come back home to ourselves. So if we can help leaders start to inventory, where are you living out of the top of your license, out of your best self, out of the part of you that is effortless, that can be genuine and present at any place, anywhere, anytime? Oh, I couldn't possibly do that. All right, well, that's the place you're starting. Not right, not wrong. It's just where you're starting. Imagine if in this situation, you could bring your sense of humor. Or take the example you gave. Imagine, colleague, if in that meeting you even spoke up one time to share your brilliance, what might be different in the opportunities you have?
Yeah.
So we start where it's practical and pragmatic and relevant to the role, that the way you're operating no longer produces the results you want. Am I right? Yeah, that's right. I'm not happy with the result. What actions are creating that result? How did you decide those actions? What was the principle or the foundational value? What was the basis of deciding that? What had you believing that that was the right basis for the situation? And the last step in reflection is, what's the data or relationship that you dismissed, deferred, or in some way said wasn't relevant? And had you paid attention to it, would have set in motion a completely different motivation and a completely different basis. Now, I don't stop there. I do one more round of deeper reflection to help them start to see, where do you have a habit of going to these two people and you leave the other four members of your team out?
Right.
Where do you have a preference to partner with that colleague? And as a result, you run into roadblocks and resistance because other people in the organization don't know what the heck you're up to. Where do you make assumptions about what people are capable of or whether they'll endorse what you want to do? Where do you have a bias that's out of date with what's actually going on? So what am I doing? I'm having them pull back and open the camera lens a little bit and look systemically, not just vertically in their own function or in their own sense of identity. And then and only then do they go, all right, now that I'm aware, this would be the belief that would be a lot more useful. These would be the reasons we would pursue that. And boy, does that open up the options of what actions we could take. We can't predict what new result will happen, but it certainly will be different than the last one that had come out of an unconscious habit, invisibly operating, because that's what we've always done. So if we attack people for staying in the status quo, they hold on tighter.
Right.
If we can help them to start to describe what are you experiencing in that thought process, how satisfying is it? It's not. We've started the change process, even in that simple question. So that's why I say I don't think it's so much training as it is reflection and claim and declare. What is it that you want to have shift? Because that's inside of you.
Begs the question, I'll say all humans, but I'm really talking about leaders. Are all leaders, do they have the capacity to be reflective?
Yes. It's a human trait.
So we have the capacity.
You have the capacity. Yep.
Okay. But it's like a muscle that you might or might not use, yeah?
That's right. That's exactly right. I think actually it's reflection is the process, but the skill for the 21st century is discernment.
Right. Right. Okay.
You might know that I did a TEDx on the subject of judgment.
Yeah.
And the reason I did that is, you know, if you look at the promise of DEI, it's all coming out of stop being judgmental. It's like,
right.
Hang on a second. Mm-hmm. If we conflate judgmental and judgment, we are making the discernment of what's actually happening here and
right.
what is it that's activating me to have a reaction here. We're short-circuiting all of that. And it's no wonder we can't make it work because we're all about the breakdown instead of what you said a few minutes ago, which is innovation and creativity, and therefore the thriving opportunity in your business is going to come out of the diverse adversity, not the similarity.
Right. Right. Ryan, you got something?
So much to unpack there.
No,
that was a ridiculous sure. amount of information. So a couple of things come to mind, and I don't want to go backwards, but shortly ago you said they need to take notice. Use the word notice, and I jotted that down real quick. I want to go deeper there. Talk okay. about that a little bit, because I'm not sure that I got it at first, but when you said it, I felt it. I felt like, oh, notice. Like, just notice. But I want to understand what you mean by that.
Absolutely. So, do you like to go to the beach?
I do.
No. I love going down there. I don't like sitting on the beach.
A bad day at the beach is better than a good day somewhere else.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
All right. So let's say that Ryan's walking the beach and William's standing on the beach, sitting in a beach.
I love the beach for this situation.
Those will work just fine. So if you can, take your attention interiorly for a moment and put yourself on a beach, some recent experience. Notice probably the first sensory experience you have is the sound of the wave coming in and out. It's a rhythm, right? You mm-hmm. can hear the water rise up on the beach and you can hear it go back out. You probably next hear seagulls or pelicans, depending on where you are on the planet. You probably then recognize that there's a salt, there's a sodium smell to that water, and that's gotten activated. If you walk into the water, you now feel the tide come up against your body, cold, and it goes back out, and now you feel the wind. And the wind against the wet leg, as opposed to the wind against the part of you that is dry. You might even feel some of the sand losing its place underneath your feet as the tide has gone back out. I just took you through a sensory experience.
That's right. You just went through all the senses.
All mm-hmm. of that is noticing.
Right.
We are noticing, but we don't pay attention to it. We don't right. give it credence. This is what meditation is all about, in the opposite way.
So when we're noticing, meaning we're archiving those things as they're happening, but what we're not either activating is whether or not those things are happening.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay, that tracks for me.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And so now you're in a meeting. I'm a leader, and I've got my team around the table, and I'm paying attention to the presentation I'm giving. And I completely miss that two of my team members are on their phones.
Uh-huh.
Somebody else is rolling their eyes and making loud noises like they're completely bored.
Yeah.
Somebody else is leaning forward, being good students.
Sure.
That scene in one of the Indiana Jones movies where she blinks her eyelashes. I love
mm-hmm. it. Oh, yeah. Signaling.
And as a leader, I'm so wrapped up in me presenting right. that I have right. no kind of
not even paying attention to that.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't mm-hmm. notice it. Now, this is an egregious example I'm giving you. It's often
sure.
in the daily life of work. It's
much more nuanced.
Much more nuanced. And yeah. we can have an act of incivility and not know it because people will not speak about it. We haven't created the conditions, and this is a leader's job, to create the conditions for people to feel welcome, to speak their mind, to be themselves.
Right.
We don't train this. This is a place, William, where I think training is important. We're not
right.
building the skill set. And it is to elevate discerning the emotional experience that someone is having with the transactional excellence that they got their job for in the first place. These need to be on a level playing field. And right now,
right.
they're like this.
I brought you in here to be the person that during the interview process we fell in love with, and your experience and also your outspokenness, your opinions, your ideas, your creativity. You're in a meeting and you're zippered up and you're not giving me any of that. So actually we're not winning because of that. You got me thinking about, you know, getting your take on the movement and the way people talk about bring your whole self to work. Mm-hmm. Now, what's your? Because I have a take, but I don't want to put my bias first. I'll definitely put it in, but I don't want to put it first. What's your take on that? When you hear that from people, what do you think?
Well, you can't not bring your whole self to work. The question is, do you let anybody else see it?
Yes. So people are bringing that whole self, but they're then deciding, I can only really activate 60% of this or show people 60% of this. That's or right. Whatever that is.
Now, multi-generational workplaces have right. a real dickens of a time here.
Because 100%.
My parents' generation
yeah.
put a very brick wall between personal right. and professional.
That's right.
My generation said, not so yeah. fast.
Yeah.
We brought a little more of our personal in. We had boundaries, but we did allow for a lighter sense of humor and letting people have a little more uniqueness. The next generation said, well, this is crazy. My personal life matters more. And I'm going to negotiate for what I want to be able to have what I want in my personal life, even if it means that I might have to push back on my professional career. And then there are some who said, no, 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 my professional career is everything. And then they are burnt out and they're in the revolving door of, I'll find the next company to help me. Great. Now go down another generation and they're like, I'm not coming to work for you.
Yes.
And they are fueling the gig economy.
Yep.
And Alpha's like, you guys have all lost your minds. The planet is burning and you're worried about a job? Right now, we're obviously whitewashing, and that's not a good thing to do. But
for
example's purpose, is yeah. not a singular answer to this question about wholeness at work. Wouldn't we all be better off if we knew what each other was thinking, what we believe, what our passions were?
See, that's where you got me, Janet.
I think this is where he was going.
I am such a dark person. So if when someone asks me what I'm thinking, I then clarify, are you sure?
Do you really want to know?
Are you sure? I'm going to give you an out right here. You got a card. You play it. Because I might be thinking about how to dispose of a body. You know, like, you sure you want to know? So, but I don't think everyone's that way. I think more people are more attuned to what you're saying. It's like, first of all, you have to activate that and say, create safety yeah. and say, hey, I care enough to ask you about what you're thinking. You have the freedom. It's just us going to silence. Like, you know, tell me what you're thinking. It would be helpful for me to know, even if we disagree.
And the cone of silence is an interesting, insidious thing as well.
Yeah.
I'm only gonna tell you if you're going to keep it confidential.
Yeah.
Meaning you're going to tell me all this great stuff, but we can't act on it?
I think the way I've heard it used isn't about things that are positive. It's more the cone of silence around things.
Exactly.
That are...
All the more reason.
I know. Exactly. No, I know.
Transparent, so we can address yeah. it.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Yeah. You're not wrong. Of course, you're not wrong. So I think that's that safety thing.
Yeah, back in the early days of coaching, and many people still subscribe to this. So I'm sure you'll have some people in the audience who'll go, "She's crazy about this," but. I have been a volunteer leader on the global level for ICF for a very, very long time. And I absolutely believe in the code of ethics and ethical conduct is important.
Right.
Confidentiality is a piece of that. But we have to ask ourselves, in service to what? My first responsibility is to the organization. What does the organization want to accomplish? How does this person or this team who is getting coaching contribute to what the organization wants? And finds a thriving going concern, which keeps that person and that team employed. My first obligation is to that. So If I have someone who tells me something confidential, my response to that is going to be, what's the conversation to be having with your boss or with your colleague or with that person over there, whatever it might be, because this is not going to resolve by having a conversation with me.
Right.
I can coach you about how to have that conversation. I understand.
Well, it's trapped. Scary. Yeah. It's that knowledge or that what could make us better is trapped. Yep. And it's sealed up, right? And it can't go over and be used to be helpful. And again, people think of the negative. It's like, well, let's take it to an extreme, sexual harassment or something like that. You know, like, okay, so someone tells you something in confidence. Okay, all right, you can hear that. But if you can't take action on it, how does that get better?
Right? Exactly right. Mm.
It That's doesn't powerful. Unless you break their trust and move forward with it.
I think it's probably having conversation. I mean, Janet will be the expert here, but I think it's more like coaching them and talking to them and being with them to then make sure the appropriate people know.
Exactly. I'm not the person to resolve this for you, person.
Right.
Yeah.
No, company has an ombudsman. We have an employee assistance program, right? We have mechanisms to help people get the courage and strength necessary.
Yeah, I'll go with you. I'll go with you. Like I can, I'll help. I'll walk down the if we're not virtual, I'll walk down the hallway. We'll do it together.
Silence condones.
Janet, I would imagine that you get a lot in coaching people that want to kind of have those conversations with you, right? They just haven't. They feel comfortable with you. They get comfortable. You're like. Going. Then they start to talk, and you're like, how do you I'm always interested in this from a coaching perspective. How do you maintain being the coach, but also have that trust factor, that feeling of trust from the employee back to you where they feel open enough? Because I would assume the fact that they're open enough or comfortable enough to feel that they can bring this to you is part of your goal. To open those barriers.
That's table stakes. So I think openness.
I think table stakes is a great way to say it, but I think you might be stepping over. There's a lot that goes into a coaching partnership, working with somebody over time. Mm-hmm. There's a chemistry meeting during which both the coach and the person who's thinking about engaging a coach have a time to get to know each other. And you can feel energetically if there's resonance. Like this person finishes my sentences, we have an easy time laughing, we test out saying some things that might be a little risky, how was it received? And then there is usually a pretty lengthy discovery session that happens and during which you deepen how you get to know each other. There might be an assessment that's used. There might be some reflection questions. There might be some exercises. There's a development plan. What are we focusing on? What's your aspiration 3 to 5 years from now? What's keeping you from living that today? How do you see your strengths? What are the areas you want to strengthen? What do you want from your boss to support you in this process? What's the behavior that's the highest, like the acupuncture point to get you into exponential flow? Where do you want to focus your attention in our coaching? Is it with your team? Is it with your peers? So that what can happen?
Right.
So this whole line of inquiry is designed to give the person time to claim and declare what's important to them. What are we addressing or resolving through the coaching partnership so that you can be better? It's the ownership that we authorize for them of the entire experience of coaching.
Right.
And then they get to accept responsibility for how fast, how far, how deep, how often that occurs. That's a partnership that's constructed. Now, I will tell you, not all coaching works the way I just described it.
No, 100%.
But that's the real promise of coaching comes when the individual is in the driver's seat.
So you've been asked this probably a million times, but the line between therapy and coaching is what?
Who has responsibility for the outcomes?
Coaching is the individual, therapy is the therapist.
The clinician. And that's true on the other side. So if I put myself in the middle of a line, I'm coach.
Right.
On the left-hand side are all the clinical practices, social science-based, counseling-based, therapeutic-based, psychiatrically-based, right?
Right.
They have liability for diagnosis.
Right.
and then responsibility for outcomes that occur. And they have liability insurance to go along with it. On this side, we have skills training, mentoring, pretty traditional supervision functions, consulting. All of these are people who have expert advice that they are transferring to that person. It's a superior subordinate relationship. They have right. accountability for the quality of the advice that they're giving. That's not what happens in coaching.
That's right.
Two adult peers coming together. The coach is responsible for a process and creating an environment that's conducive to a person doing learning, growth, and change. And the right. client is responsible for how they engage with it and what they do with it after. I get a half an hour with them once a week. They got 6 days and 23 and a half hours to live their life. I can only influence in that 30 minutes that they might have a learning insight about themselves right. and make a commitment to themselves to choose differently.
You know where I thought Ryan was going originally with this question was people that you interact with and your team interacts with that they say all the right things. They shake their head and they're like they're agreeing with you, but they have either a problem or some type of conflict or an inability to then action it.
Yeah.
So what do you when you?
When I you, actually I love
you,
it when
you
I,
know what I'm, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about, okay. And you know, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, everybody starts from a different position.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? We all have different circumstances that bring us to a moment when we say, I want a thought partner. I want a sounding board. I want a coach, whatever it might mm-hmm. be. Wherever you start is where you start, period. There's no right. There's no wrong. This is not a binary process. And the most value that a client gets is when they start to see, oh, I made a commitment last week in our session that I would do X, Y, Z. And I realize I never thought about X, Y, and Z all week long. To which I'm going to say, great, you noticed. You didn't pay attention to it. What right. does that tell you about how you make commitments? What is it that you were evidencing when you made that commitment to yourself at the end of the session? And, you know, clients will always say, well, you talked me into it. I said, really? That's interesting. No. How did you let that happen? At what point in the session did you let me talk you into something?
Yeah.
I said, you know,
That's an easy out, though.
Yeah, it's lazy.
I mean, that's an easy out to say you talked me into this when they really are saying you opened my eyes. I then figured it out, and then I got that.
And not doing it, okay. You know what I really could have committed to because I thought I actually did last week was this, and this. Okay, right. What's the difference between the two? How are you calibrating your rubric for making a decision about what choices you want to make?
Right.
That's the value. That's the source of the change that's sustainable right. for them.
Right. So much of this is marriage counseling. Do you feel like you could be a better husband now?
I feel like I'm getting stared at.
I'm going to go talk to my wife after this.
I'm just going to go say I love you, honey.
Yeah. First of all, I've made a lot of mistakes. I just want to end.
My wife is so happy you're coaching me.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Well, you know, you've heard, I mean, this isn't new. You've heard this before. But what is, so why do you have leaders that say, you know, no, or they somehow don't get it? Like I'm thinking of in the sales process, we call it fear, uncertainty, and doubt, right? So at some point, there's people say no to this, right? And they'll say it, they don't have the budget, or you know, they'll use other kind of tactics, right? But really what they're saying is they don't want to be this vulnerable, they don't want to be this open, they don't want to be this reflective, they want to focus on other things, etc. So what do you do with those people, first of all? Or do you just avoid them and just kind of move on to people that kind of get it?
No, they're actually my favorite people to stay in conversation with. Because they're not actually rejecting the thing they really want. What they're saying is, I haven't quite seen the value formula here. What will be different in my life when I make a commitment to make this change?
Right.
And until they can get to the aspirational vision that's bigger and more important than them, than the current safety of the identity they're operating out of, we're not moving. And I'm not going to be successful coaching this person until they do that.
Yeah, so they're no good for you at this point anyhow.
Well, Brian goes to the gym a lot. And so we talk a lot about that. And it's like, until you're willing to make a change, you're not going to make a change. I mean, I was probably in my mid-30s when I realized that giving advice to people that haven't asked for my advice is a waste of my time. Well, but it took me into my mid-30s.
Arrogance, William.
It is. It is. Oh, no, 100%. I realized that I was in my swimming pool with my brother, and I was giving him advice. And then I realized he didn't ask me for my advice. And so I reoriented myself around, I'm not going to give people unsolicited advice.
Right.
I'm going to wait until they say, William, what do you think? And the moment they say, William, what do you think? Now I got a chance. I've got an in. Now that doesn't mean anything will change.
Well, so stay with that for a second, because what you could do to morph that skill when they ask you, what do you think, is to say, what's bringing this to your attention right now?
Nice.
Stay in the learner stance.
Right.
And let them speak about what they're experiencing that's even asking. They're abandoning their own inner authority and asking you to live their life for them.
Not great. I'm stealing that. That's mine now.
If you ask me these questions, I know where it came from. I know it's not sincere. So you can't do this to me.
I'm not mediating that.
No.
We're marking this at the 48-minute mark.
I won't use it on you, but it is such a great tool, because you're absolutely right. It's instead of just jumping right in, because I would normally and naturally just jump right into the advice.
Yeah.
And so instead of doing that, just hit pause and go, okay, why are we here? Why are you thinking this? Why are you asking me? What's driving that?
How you become generative. This is what organizations need now, because there's no way a leader can ever know everything there is to know about their people or what they're up to.
It's not just now. That's never been the case. I mean, it's never been the case.
It's even more acute today because of the
100%
complexity.
Right. Wow. Janet, this has been so fantastic. Thank you so much. Ryan, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I do not. I think this is a fantastic way to end. We may need a part two.
We need, this is a part two.
That would be my honor. I'd be delighted to come back. You both have been a joy to chat with.
Vice versa. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Ryan, you have a thing that you like to do at the end of the shows.
Yeah, if you're still listening, subscribe, like us everywhere. If you see us out in public, say hello.